from the Sky News Centre at 5. Theresa May's call today an important step in delivering a smooth and orderly Brexit after EU leaders agreed talks can move on to the next phase. Discussions on the UK's future trade relationship with the EU are not expected to begin until March, though. Details of the transition period still need firming up, but the Prime Minister says today's agreement is an important step in the exit process.
I'm pleased that it's been agreed we should make rapid progress on an implementation period, which will give certainty to businesses and individuals. There's still more to do, but we're well on the road to delivering a Brexit that will make Britain prosperous, strong and secure.
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have confirmed the date of their wedding. They'll get married on May the 19th next year. Matt Steele has the details.
We already knew the couple would tie the knot at Windsor in May, but the exact date's a bit of a surprise. Choosing a Saturday goes against tradition, as royal weddings tend to take place on weekdays. It also falls on the same day as the FA Cup final, where Harry's brother, and we assume best man, usually presents the trophy. And it does mean an end to those calls for us to get a public holiday to mark the occasion.
The family of four children killed in a house fire in Greater Manchester say they've been robbed of their future. Three people have been remanded in custody until March over the blaze in Salford. A man's been shot by military police after he threatened to use a knife at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport. Authorities say the situation is safe and a suspect has been detained. A reward offered to find missing airman Corey McCaig has been doubled to £100,000. Police have stopped searching a landfill site after finding no trace of the serviceman who vanished after a night out in Suffolk last September. And Ryanair has announced it will recognise pilot unions in six European countries, including the UK and Ireland, as it tries to avoid disruption over Christmas. The airline's now calling for threatened industrial action on Wednesday to be called off. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news. Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, dogfights over Syria between Russian and American jets this week. Who's going to shoot who down first? What are the Americans up to in Syria? Still bombing and killing civilians despite ISIS being wiped out and the other rebels supposedly being their allies. Just can't admit, perhaps, that the regime change plan has hit a Russian brick wall. And a radio play on tonight and tomorrow evening at All Hallows Hall here in Easton. It's called Dr. Watson and the Communist Plot, where Lenin comes to London plotting with Sherlock Holmes' brother Mycroft to... Well, you'll hear more later. The US military developing Terminator genes to wipe out dangerous species of mosquitoes. But could this technology be used against people? And PressCoin, a new currency designed to pay for investigative journalism. Plus, the second part of our look at the rise to power of Israel's far-right Likud party under the stewardship of their leader Benjamin Netanyahu. Seems to be a permanent fixture on the scene these days. But we take a look at the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords in September 1995 and Jerusalem's biggest ever peace rally, on the evening of which Prime Minister who was behind this peace, Yitzhak Rabin, was assassinated. A wave of terrorist attacks followed on which Netanyahu rode to power in the May 1996 election. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 2 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs inching up to 10 Celsius. Sunniest tomorrow morning, cloudy with a few showers over the rest of the weekend. Next week, 11 Celsius highs, a mainly cloudy week with a few sunny spells and a few showers too. Next weekend, it's Christmas weekend, the 23rd, 24th and 25th of December. That is highs around 7 Celsius, or actually going down a bit, temperatures, and sunny spells and showers, possibly dry with sunny spells on Christmas Day. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather broadcast from theweatheroutlook.com. First, an apology, though, and correction from last week's show. Our guest, who was in to talk about the news, fake news, cognitive science professor Stefan Lewandowski from Bristol University, said there was a study that psychology students which proved people who believe Princess Diana was assassinated by MI6 also believe she faked her own death. Well, I've had a good look into the Kent and Winchester University study called Dead and Alive. It's clear once you get to see the raw data that's not the case. Only two of the 170 or so students who were surveyed, that's about 1%, expressed the view that Diana had faked her own death, which is outside the margin of being a usable statistic. They could simply have been ticking boxes without even reading the questions, for example. Both those two students who said they thought Diana faked her own death also said she was probably killed by MI6, but not the other way round. Anyway, the sample there is so small as to be discounted from any serious study, so I apologise if anyone got the idea that proved people that believe Diana was assassinated are incoherent. That's simply not the case in that survey, Professor Lewandowski cited. Anyway, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Foda. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks very much.
Give us an idea of your exploits this week at the City Council, Martin, because I know it's been full council and a Q&A with the Mayor.
Yes, that's right. Every full council, other than the budget meeting, we get to ask any questions, make statements or present petitions to the Mayor. And that's called Members Forum. It's the hour before the council meeting starts. And so I had some questions in there, including one on the parking schemes in the funding for transport projects in Bristol. And the mayor revealed the surplus that is available from residents' parking schemes in the city, and that funding is not allowed to be spent on anything normal for the council. It has to be identified for transport projects. And although it was a bit vague, it was promised that there might be the possibility of surplus from residents' parking schemes being used to help new areas get parking under control where it's not currently being managed. And in the same meeting, a group of residents from my area, from my ward and the adjacent ward, on both sides of Gloucester Road, Redland and Ashley wards, came with their own statements and questions about the parking chaos in their area and the need to do something to solve the problems. And they were really positive by the end of it. They felt Marvin had agreed that there were issues they do need to deal with, but he is still suggesting ward councillors have to solve it for them without any resources or any support from officers. And what we're working on is trying to see if we can get some professional backup to solve the chaos of commuter parking.
Okay, well, this is just what it's all about. Is it commuter parking? Surely if there's residents parking in there, commuters simply can't do that. They'll get booked.
But at the moment, there are no parking schemes to manage anything, whether it's shoppers, traders or commuters. And that is a very real problem on both sides of Gloucester Road and a number of other areas in and around the central.
I mean,
Bristol.
How does this work? Is it the whole of a ward will be covered by a parking scheme? When does a parking scheme start and finish?
There are 15 current parking schemes that have been built up over the last few years, and they're not allowed to make a profit for the council. But where there's a lot of pay and display, they do tend to build up a surplus above the cost of paying off the loans that built them. And what
so
we're
they could buy new fantastic parking meters or something.
Well,
look
we're,
really
we're
wonderful.
Trying to work out if that surplus is available for transport projects. The reason this is so important is a year ago, all of the transport projects across every neighbourhood of Bristol were wiped out. The budgets were taken away. The officer liaison was taken away. The technical help was taken away. So basically nothing is happening. No safe crossings, no bad junctions sorted out, no parking projects developed. And people are seeing their neighbourhood unsafe for children to get to school and so on. And at the moment, councillors have absolutely no way of helping them progress those projects.
But it sounds like some positive signs this week, though, from what you're saying. Marvin is listening and he's going to be making some changes.
He's starting to listen, and he's asked the cabinet member, Vari Threffel, to actually talk to the residents now and talk to myself. She's very much happy to meet, she said. And what we have is new schemes being being referred to councillors and a very complex process being described that doesn't actually help us deliver anything for our residents, which is very frustrating for us and for the residents who know that they might spend several years talking to us and still not get anything solved, whether there's parking chaos or unsafe junctions or children being, you know, hit on their way to school.
Now, you started off by making it sound like you thought Marvin was doing a good job, and you finished off by thinking, well, actually, you know, this is a bit of a fudge. So which is it?
Well, we don't yet know if any money will be available. We don't know if any officers will help us. All we know is he started to hear what the residents are saying, which compared to the month before when he told me I was campaigning and he wasn't interested in that because he'd promised there would be no new parking schemes imposed. And I said, no, I'm representing my residents. And lo and behold, a group of them come and make statements, and he listens to what they have to say now.
What about other things that you've asked questions about this week then?
Those were the main questions I put on transport budgets. But colleagues have been raising a number of issues and making statements and questions around drugs policy and... well, of course, there was a big debate on austerity that has been in the news. Labour suddenly saying they're not very happy with austerity, which is interesting. But the Greens pushing them to actually do something about that problem.
So, I mean, what you seem to be saying there is that although Labour is not at Bristol City Council's not embracing austerity, it actually hasn't really got much of a argument against it because it's simply just got to do it.
Well, it's interesting you say they're not embracing austerity because this council, along with all the other Labour-led core cities, the major cities that we're a sort of group of, nine or ten of us, they're all busy implementing austerity. But we do now have...
I don't have a choice, do they? I mean, they're given a certain amount of money do the services. They have to then don't they?
The budget is controlled. The government cuts of the budget available from Whitehall is very much controlled by government. There's no question about that. But what we're finding is that they're busy implementing it so effectively that actually public services will be wiped out. And, you know, for all we know, in a year's time, the government could collapse. There might be different policies, but we're busy dismantling the services as fast as can be done, get it ahead of the final year of the mayor's tenure, perhaps. And we see them saying they don't like it, but they're busy doing it. And we think that's not really good enough. We don't see the 10 core cities all lined up telling the government this isn't really good enough. The government has caved in to a number of sort of people have stood up to it recently. The unionists from Northern Ireland is one example. And when they object, the government actually has backed down on certain issues. And yet here we are, all the cities saying we're busy implementing the cuts. We don't like it, but we'll implement them, don't worry.
We've had a recent vote of no confidence in the mayor from the Unite Union.
That was interesting, yes.
Which is, I mean, okay, so it's only, I think, just under 1,000 members of Unite that have decided to have a vote of no confidence
in the
mayor.
But that's significant, coming from a trade union.
And it almost seems like that the Labour, what you'd expect to be Labour left, is criticising the way that the cuts are being implemented in the city more than you are, Martin.
Well, the good example recently was Acorn, the community union that stood up for tenants, and the Green Party have both objected to the council busy implementing a cut to the council tax reduction scheme. And the mayor has recently trumpeted in the Labour's own party newsletter that the mayor has saved the council tax reduction scheme for 1 year. Which means he's going to face the same problem next year, but also omits to mention he was about to implement cuts to it, and he's actually changed his tune because of the opposition from both Acorn and the Green Party.
Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees has told he's blackmailing the city and favouring government over residents in an open letter from a section of Unite the Union.
That's right.
This is on the 8th of December, just around a week ago. Do you think, I mean, what's the, just give us an idea of whereabouts you stand on this, because at the end of the day, the city council here is given a certain amount of money to play with. That money is shrinking and shrinking. Surely it's
very
just not fair to blame the city council for that. That's something which has been decided up at Westminster.
Absolutely, and we'd like the council to stand up. I mean, Marvin led a march against austerity in Bristol. A few days later was in London hoping to meet the government, although they didn't meet him. But what he took to take to the government if they'd been willing to meet him, was a statement that the core cities would like the government to allow cities more freedom and promote more big infrastructure projects. And the word austerity and the term cuts was not even present in the document they took to London. So the core cities, including Marvin, have not objected to austerity. They've asked the government for big infrastructure projects that might obviously create jobs and help the economy in the cities. So we could get government investment or big public projects, but we're not going to see a cut to the things that are decimating our services. And the Green Party certainly has said, surely the mayor of this city and all the other major cities that comprise such a big part of the economy of this country should be actually standing up and saying, stop such extreme cuts.
Well, I'd love to ask Marvin Rees, the mayor, that, but his office don't reply to my phone calls. Don't reply to the phone calls.
Because he's been to China to talk to investors there. And the other thing Acorn and ourselves have pointed out, he was trumpeting the very high and rising property prices here because it's such a boom and such a shortage of accommodation that wouldn't it be great if Chinese investors came and built lots of new private sector housing, private rent and student housing in the city.
Well, surely we need investment. We need investment, don't we?
Being assured how profitable it's going to be because of the high and rising property prices and the shortage. And we feel that's very much an inappropriate way to sell the city. Look, you're going to make a profit out of tenants here.
Martin Summers, what do you make of this? I mean, Marvin and his trip to China, there's got to be questions over any kind of deals with the Chinese. I mean, is it fair to call them government or should we be calling them regime? I'm not really sure. But certainly
they have the Communist Party and their enterprises.
Well, they have very little respect for human rights. Indeed. For example, freedom of speech, that you can do up to 3 years in jail for laughing at the national anthem now in Hong Kong. What do you make of the idea of prospect of Chinese investment? Does it matter, Martin?
Well, I'm not quite sure who he's talking to, whether he's talking to investors who've got money, private money, or whether he's talking to government. So, I mean, I don't know enough about this scheme to make a
detailed
comment.
As I understand it, the Chinese investment system is largely not been privatised like over here has been.
That's not true. I mean, it's a mixed system. What you've got in China today, but at one stage, if you remember, the ideology in the West was that the Chinese had given up communism and that they'd kind of thrown it all out of the window and they'd become capitalists in all but name. But now, of course, they're being accused of being communists because they've still got a state-run banking system. They've got the township and village enterprises in China, which are very successful over many decades, are basically local authority plus private entrepreneurs.
But is it okay to sell Bristol on the idea of, oh, that rents here are really high, come and invest, you'll make loads of money out of Bristolians?
I've only just heard over the last couple of days about these proposals. I mean, it strikes me that what you're trying to do there is you're trying to, because you haven't got the resources from central government to do what local authorities should be doing, you know, providing libraries, community services and so forth, you then become an entrepreneurial leader and you go, say, to China, could we go to Saudi Arabia and borrow money to invest? And in other words, instead of running a local council, you're becoming an entrepreneurial leader. And I think that is fundamentally wrong. That's why I was opposed to the mayoral system in the first place and why I didn't really particularly agree with George Ferguson's approach to this. A Labour mayor of Bristol should be actually a loyal, rustless screw, as Li Feng used to be called in China, the rustless screw of the revolution. You've got to actually just basically be a foot soldier to get this wretched government out and change the rules of the game. You shouldn't be trying to play within those rules and then say, well, we're going to be entrepreneurial, because that's what they want. That's what they want from a mayor of Bristol. They want them to go out and try and, you know, bring in investors because the government doesn't want to spend money on social services. I mean, basically, you're playing their game. That's... But I mean, I wait to be convinced. You know, Marvin is, you know, has got to convince people if that's what he wants to do.
Well, I mean, it's been suggested with Chinese investment, we'll have an underground system within 10 years, major development down at the Cumberland Basin, funded by Chinese investors potentially.
But the Chinese are not going to invest in the city unless they can take a lot of money out of the city.
That's right.
The old idea, surely, of a council is that any money that's made in an investment scheme of any sort, and we've been talking last week a lot about the big council house schemes that the council are now building, that money will stay in-house. If someone else comes in and does this, yes, there'll be jobs for a while. Right. Quite how well paid they'll be is another question. But then after that, you've got an enormous kind of Trojan horse, if you want, in your city, sucking money out across the other side of the world.
That's right. I mean, I'm very much in favour of the approach that we try to create the municipal initiatives, the municipal enterprises, that ultimately our fellow cities across Europe and elsewhere in the world are running, where the municipality owns the energy company, the housing, the water system, the waste.
But those days are gone, surely. Those days are gone.
They were taken away, nationalised and then privatised. And so we now have so little control. Our colleagues across Europe, their jaws drop in shock at the fact we're running almost nothing.
But we've got so little control. Yeah, in fact, the same in London, that we had the Grenfell Tower disaster. Well, it's called by some locals the atrocity, because it was actually not an accident. It was something which was warned of many times by the locals. And the local authority and various other authorities simply didn't do anything to stop it. So, Martin Summers, this is a bit about, surely the Grenfell thing is a bit about the people who are supposed to be coming in and checking to see if the builders have done things right are actually controlled by the builders often, and there's no effective regulation left. In fact, this is obviously in the interests of big contractors to just completely control, to take over the regulators.
Well, what's happened is that local government has been hollowed out completely. It's basically run by developers, and what the suspicion is, for example, the idea of bringing back powerboat racing in the docks, which of course is pretty silly. I mean, it was banned initially because health and safety banned it, because they used to crash into the walls of the docks. It's not a suitable place. But obviously somebody had bent Marvin's ear to suggest bringing it back, and eventually the whole idea crashed and burned. But what it suggests to me is that he's going out touting for business to do anything, because they can't actually do the core things that they're supposed to be doing, because they can't do those. So they then invent a whole new thing that they're doing, basically managing Bristol as an entrepreneurial enterprise. And I question that. We shouldn't actually be going along with that. We should be moving towards municipal enterprise by all means. But for that, we've got to get the national government out. And as Martin rightly points out, that's feasible. And it may be possible
and
to bump them out quickly.
In 2020, I'm sure you've got a little while to wait for that.
But the government lost lost a vote in the House of Commons this week, and they're possibly going to lose one next week.
They're not going to lose a vote of no confidence, are they?
Not necessarily. They will, Tony. They will, because before Brexit gets through...
No, they won't.
Tony, I bet you money they would not go on till 2020. They won't.
Why not?
They'll try and go quickly if they manage to survive nearer the date. But in actual fact, this government is definitely on the ropes. What will happen afterwards is anybody's guess. But the idea that they are going to limp on like this is simply wrong. The Tory party is completely divided.
All that's happened
more divided than it's been since the arguments about the Corn Laws.
All that's happened is they've battened down the hatches. They're not going anywhere till 2020.
But they are weak at the moment. And that is the time to push back, not to say we'll go along with your way of doing things. And that's the frustration, I think, some of my colleagues and I have. It's that they're too readily saying publicly the council will get out of the way of the community. The community will run things for themselves. We'll find investors to run anything else. We'll put up the charges and fees we can wherever possible to get a bit of income from events and spectaculars. And
what about basic stuff like street cleaning and taking away our rubbish?
Well, the interesting thing is the graph of doom, as you may have heard, which is the collapse of the budget due to the government removing...
This isn't just Bristol, by the way. It's
all
over the country.
This is local government generally, but especially the major cities, which tend to be Labour-run, is that within 4 to 5 years, the gap between what needs to be spent on our services as they currently are and what will be available is equivalent. It's about over 100 million, 108 million, I think. And that is equivalent to every single service other than young and old social care and the waste system. So anything else you've heard of the council doing in Bristol, which includes all the libraries and so on, actually will not have a budget.
Martin Summers, I guess this is why you got your fingers crossed for a general election, isn't it?
Yes, because there's only one way to change this. I'm not really a big believer in localism. Like I said when George Ferguson was on this show, at this level, you can only do so much. And what a Labour council in particular should be doing is saying, we've got to change the central government policy. And most people, when we knock on doors in local elections, vote Labour because they know they want to change central government policy. They're not actually that interested. They know the council. That's why there's such a low turnout in local council elections. People ain't stupid. They know that the council doesn't decide very much. It's only the core vote that turns out. And of course, people do vote in the Grand National because they know that that's where the decisions are taken.
Okay, well, let's have a listen back to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday this week, where Jeremy Corbyn was asking, the Labour leader was asking Prime Minister Theresa May all about the decrease in the number of people owning their own homes under the Conservatives, which I was quite surprised at the statistic on that one.
Under the Tories, home ownership has fallen by 200,000. Under Labour, it rose by 1 million. And 40% of all homes sold through Right to Buy are now in the private rented sector. The latest figures, Mr. Speaker, show that a quarter of all privately rented homes are not up to decent standards, meaning many families are living in homes with damp that are not secure or very poorly insulated. Does the Prime Minister support homes being fit for human habitation?
We want homes to be fit for human habitation, but can I just remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that the number of homes failing to meet the decent home standard is down by 49% since the peak under the Labour government. While I'm talking about the record of the Labour government, statutory homelessness peaked under the Labour government and is down by over 50% since then. It's this government that is delivering for people on housing. It's his government that Labour failed to deliver over 13 years.
Okay, so statutory homeless down by 50%. I was quite surprised at that figure, and I wasn't the only one, because Theresa May, this is in the Independent, Theresa May is facing an investigation after a misleading Parliament, in inverted commas, about the scale of homelessness. Britain's Statistic Watchdog is considering an investigation into comments made by Theresa May following complaints they misrepresented the extent of homelessness. UK Statistics Authority confirmed concerns had been raised after Prime Minister claimed Parliament that statutory homelessness peaked under the Labour government and is down by 50% since then. Well, certainly, I don't know about you, anyone else here in the studio, but I've not seen it decreasing. I keep seeing more and more people begging and more people sleeping rough on the streets. And Mrs May made the claim as she clashed with the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn in Prime Minister's questions early this week. The actual fact of the... I'll talk about the statistics from the National Statistics Authority in a minute, but what's your feeling about this, Martin Foder from the Green Party?
Well, I think you're right that what we see around us and what we see in the streets of Bristol is far more people sleeping in doorways, looking as if they're homeless. They've been left behind by the services that used to exist that have now shrunk. So the services that help people with mental health, with resettlement, with all sorts of things, whatever their background is, are weaker now, and more people are falling through that net. And as far as I'm concerned, there's significantly more visible in Bristol the last year or two than there was before.
Statutory homelessness, they say, did peak under Labour in 2003. Mm-hmm. It fell significantly in the following 7 years before they lost power, and subsequently risen under the Conservatives. Some 10,100 families in England were accepted as homeless during April and June 2010 when the coalition government was elected. At the time of Mrs May's comments this week, the figure was 14,000. So actually, she's kind of being a bit clever with her statistics there.
It's rising.
It's actually gone up something like
50%.
It's gone up 50% since the Tories were elected in 2010, Martin Summers.
Yeah, well, it just shows how manipulated people's perceptions can be. But I think everything I've seen suggests is that the problem of homelessness is increasing, particularly with universal credit, because private landlords have basically said flat out, we won't rent to people on universal credit. Mm. And so as soon as they bring, that's why they've not been able to roll it out, because every time they try and roll it out, they're just basically condemning people to being evicted.
Yeah, because of payment delays and things.
Well, exactly, they're not prepared to do it. And of course, that's built into universal credit, because Ian Duncan Smith's brainwave, that they were all going to learn how to be middle class home, you know, managing their budgets on a monthly basis, etc. But of course, these people rent from fairly rapacious private landlords. And there's a big Tory donor private landlord in the southeast who said straight away, I'm going to evict everybody on benefits in my houses, and I'm going to bring in Eastern Europeans who will pay the rent. That's what he said immediately as soon as they said it. And that's why they've not been able to roll it out, because every time they try and roll it out to families and so on, it's quite likely that their landlords are going to evict them, and then they're just going to come in through another door from the council and say, well, you've got to rehouse us.
Well, trying to bring this down to home here in Bristol a little bit, in the Bristol Post this week, under there, it's a rather good section on the Bristol Post website, actually. They've got a constant sort of little blog you can look at called The Housing Crisis. 80 new homeless people a month in Bristol, as family breakdowns given as the most common reason. And they've got a little graph here just explaining things. Latest figures for the most recent quarter, 3 months of July, August and September 2017, show a rise in the number of people being officially accepted as new homeless people by the City Council. During these 3 months, another 241 people were added to the register of people without a home. So this is climbing all the time. It's worse than it's, I don't know about ever, but it's certainly getting worse at the moment, Martin.
That's
right. What are we going to do about this?
It's really hard, because only certain people will be accepted as homeless after all. So, of course, yeah, again, the statistics can tell us.
I mean, surely the Chinese are going to be able to help here. If they can help build houses, then that means that
private rental blocks is what's being kind of sought from them, as far as I understand. I don't think it would be normal family houses. It will be blocks of private rental sector housing, which we already have in the city, and we've got other investors, pension funds, sort of doing that. But I mean, the worrying thing is lots of people aren't going to be helped anyway. Young single people kind of virtually don't exist as far the official kind of criteria and so on. So, unless there is a family.
Well, there's a catch 22 here, isn't it? As the government removes support for homeless people, and I applied for Get On The Housing Register a few years ago, and I was kicked out of my previous house, my previous flat, and they basically advised me, don't even bother, because you're a single person, you're not going to get anywhere. So they don't register, and then of course the member of statutory homeless goes down, because you've just turned a load of people away and said you've got no hope, and therefore they're not statutorily homeless. It's the same sort of lies that happens with unemployment figures. Every time you change regulations, unemployment goes down. You just kick a load of people off it.
Government Minister Nicky Morgan, she was hauled over the coals on Question Time last night over this, and completely failed to, I think it was Barnsley they were holding it, completely failed to convince the audience, who were jeering at her effectively, saying, why can't you do something about homelessness? I think it's something that we've seen increasing ever since the Thatcher years, really, but it's getting to incredible proportions now. Martin, Summers, I want you to give us, what is the quick pill solution to actually sorting that? We had a chat to Paul Smith about this last week. It's quite clear the City Council is committed to building more council houses, actually, because the trouble is they've got to sell off. They're forced to sell off the ones they've already got. But what can we do in the long term?
The obvious thing to do if you're in a hole, stop digging. So stop, let the council, social housing organisations carry on keeping their stock. I mean, it's pretty bizarre for a government that believes in subsidiarity and devolution, that housing associations, which are not government bodies, are being told by the government what to do with their own assets. Absurd. I mean, the whole point was that they were going to be independent of government. Perhaps they shouldn't be. And the other thing, of course, is change the universal credit regulations and make it possible for rent to be paid directly to private landlords. That would stop an awful lot. That's an administrative decision that they could take, which would completely change the atmosphere. But, of course, it would basically mean getting rid of Ian Duncan Smith's marvellous social engineering project. And they're not prepared to do that because of the internal politics in the Tory party don't allow that. That's pretty sickening, actually, when you can see that something that's so obviously stupid being done in order to keep the Tory party happy and keep Ian Duncan Smith's ego from being offended. And then the other thing, of course, is I wouldn't build more houses. Obviously, we should build more houses. We should take over empty existing commercial property and convert it into social
housing. Haven't we got a sort of really fundamental problem here? And I was looking at Dimbleby and Question Time last night, thinking, this is the question, no one's saying this. And that is that they don't want house prices to start falling, which would happen if you had everyone housed. This artificial demand for housing, which is creating this bubble. Mm. As soon as those house prices start to fall, everyone starts getting nervous, biting their nails, because this is underpinning the entire economy.
Well, this is the fundamental problem with the way Britain's macroeconomy has been managed for two generations now. That's why we've got a productivity failure, because money in this country goes into property. And it's actually geared. It's what I call the inflationist block in the southeast. They want property prices to bubble up. It's a great.
But it's
money
not just the southeast, is it? Prices start going down, anyway. Let's hear your thoughts on that, Martin, because that surely there's a big financial incentive for the government to say, well, actually, we don't really want house prices to start going down. That would be a disaster.
No, they don't. And everything, all the money they put in, actually keeps them high. So they're help to buy. And you know, money that goes to landlords, not to people who need a house, but goes to the landlords they're paying the rent to, and it goes to the builder who builds the new houses under Help to Buy. But I mean, I think one very straightforward but seemingly impossible to allow thing is to actually allow councils, the public sector, to borrow at low public sector loans rates. And then be a developer without needing the 20% profit that notionally we're meant to allow the viability of private sector developments.
Well, that's exactly what Paul Smith, Labour
and he's working really hard.
Was talking about
working really hard on that. But at the same time, as public investment in social housing, which is what we really need, reasonably low rents that people can afford, is also, I think, to allow. The many, many groups of potential builders and community housing developers to speed up their projects. Now, we've got one or two interesting projects in Bristol where people have built their own homes, where community land trusts are already underway, and there could be so many more if the council enabled.
Well, just if people weren't listening last week, Paul Smith did say any community groups that have spied a bit of land that's owned by the council, if they can work with the council to just put a proposal together, they will give them the land.
Well,
that's they're saying.
That's a big step forward.
I mean, so long as it's not a park, yeah, folks?
Oh, indeed.
like Gary Hopkins, if you remember the Gary Hopkins and the Parks episode.
The surplus parks.
Anyway, staying with the City Council here, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees is promising to increase protection for music venues. Now, I guess this is good for some, but not necessarily good for everyone, because some people who like to get sleep at night don't want. And what's happening is that new housing developments are being built near existing music venues without really a thought about whether people are going to be sleeping at night with loud music going on, Martin.
Well, yes. I chaired a planning committee that recently did give permission to housing on the Redcliffe Wharf, a little way away from the Thekla, well-known music venue, one that I've enjoyed many, many visits to in the past. Lots of music I've enjoyed there. But there... They're sort of panicking somewhat, I think it's fair to say, because they're saying they're likely to be shut down by the new development, which is primarily office and other mixed uses, but also some apartments on Redcliffe Wharf, near the cliffs, looking across the harbour.
Isn't this just a problem of planning generally, that you've got music venues grown up in areas where there's nobody living there, and then suddenly someone says, we think this is where someone should live?
And the same happened to... the Fleece, except there it was the government deregulating the permission needed by conversion of office to apartments. So anyone who buys an office block can turn it to apartments with no planning permission unless they actually change the external building. And so flats have now been built next to the Fleece as well. So that feels very threatened. It's directly across the road from it. And again, I've enjoyed many a musical night at the Fleece.
How do you sort that out, though, from licensing point of view? If you've got people living cheek by jowl with a music venue.
Well, actually, you mentioned licensing. There are two completely separate regulatory processes. As I say, I've chaired a planning committee currently, one of the two in the city. And I've also in the past been on the licensing committee, which allows public entertainment, and they need a license. So the threat to an existing venue is that there might be complaints and it might not have its license renewed. There might be complaints that stick against its license. So clearly anyone running a venue has to stick to the conditions of their license. But what I've proposed in conjunction with my colleague Stephen Clark, who's on the other planning committee in Bristol, there are two, is that an agent of change policy should be brought in. And the idea is that the agent of change is the new developer. What it means is what's changing is the new development, the new project, the new housing. And anyone bringing that in has to be responsible for soundproofing it, for making sure it's responding to the fact it's next to an existing venue, which could be a music venue or could, in the case of the other planning committee, be a dockyard, a boatyard that's a bit noisy, but a warehouse next to it is about to be turned into apartments. So you say, well, the apartments is what's new. The
flats,
the
flats. Flats, yeah, in old
apartments,
money.
Apartments, that's right.
That's an American word.
But the existing... Sure, sorry about that.
All right.
Gee, our apologies. but the existing use, which could be a boatyard, but often we've heard about recently, is a music venue, is already there. So we need the planning application and the developer to take account of that. They are creating the change. They need to soundproof and safeguard the existing use nearby. And it's been brought in by the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and he's suggested that the agent of change principle should apply in London.
Well, it sounds like you've
and
got
we're saying the that, same yeah. in Bristol. And the Mayor has been sympathetic, and he did make a statement. He issued a statement saying he was going to look into this. And what it needs is a policy in the new Bristol local plan that's being reviewed right now. I'm on the working group that's developing policies. So we've put forward that such a policy relating to change like this should be written into it. And it will hopefully stick. That what that doesn't do is stop music venues looking after any nuisance and noise that comes out of them when people spill out in the early hours and throw up in streets nearby and so on. That could still cause nuisance. But what they might be assured of is that any new development will be properly soundproof.
I suppose the other thing is if people are being annoyed by a venue, whether it's new or whether their home is new near it, you just have to complain, basically, well, don't you? Just write to the licensing, is it?
Well, the nuisance complaint would be made to licensing.
Yeah.
But what I suggested at planning committee was actually the developer should instruct their agents to notify buyers that you're buying near an established music venue.
Well, if that was in that would certainly help.
At the very least, you would say, I'm not surprised there's a bit of music.
Also, another bit of news this week. Bristol wants to be the first city, apparently, if you don't know if you agree with this, to use electronic voting to elect its politicians. This is new Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones, is leading the charge for e-voting in the city. And the City Council is backing the move. Now, this rings massive alarm bells for me, particularly with having seen, this is quite a long time ago, this is with the, one of the US...
Hanging Chads and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, and also talk in over the last few months about, even though it's probably complete and utter nonsense, about the Russians hacking voting machines in the US elections. So maybe Martin Summers, you can say something about this. What do you think about Darren Jones wants to be able to stay at home looking after his children whilst voting? And he doesn't like the idea of actually going out and putting a cross in a piece of paper.
In Venezuela, they have electronic voting machines, but there's also a paper ballot, which can be checked against the electronic voting.
That's very bureaucratic.
In Honduras, there's just been a disputed election in which electronic voting has been implicated in the current pro-US military government, as it was, because it came to power through a coup, have rigged the election, and they closed down the electronic voting and claim that they'd won and the opposition are not happy. I think the problem with electronic voting is hacking, and it can, you know, I mean, people, the purpose of having secret ballots with papers and pencils and all the rest of it is if it can be checked and rechecked and rechecked.
You can actually go on to YouTube and see a kind of film of how to hack a voting machine. Do this, put this in, and, you know, it just seems to me a little bit...
Well, the whole idea of hacking elections then becomes feasible, and therefore you can then run it out as a kind of, a political tactic to accuse people.
Can you also hack a ballot box and rub out someone?
Of course.
You can, That's why you've got to have, and people shouldn't presume that elections are always free and fair in this country or anywhere else. Plenty of people in Northern Ireland wouldn't agree with that.
Is one method more secure than the other?
I think paper ballots are more secure because it's more, you know, you've got to actually have somebody sit down and forge the ballots and all the rest of it. It can be done, but it's more easy to detect. The thing is, with any electronic machine, is it can be hacked. And then, of course, that you then get the question of legitimacy. People saying, well, we think you fiddled it. And there's strong evidence to suggest electronic voting machines were implicated in George W. Bush's second electoral victory in Ohio, where the code was changed. And the guy who actually did it for the Republican Party was subsequently died in very mysterious circumstances. And if people think that stuff doesn't go on in the United States of America, I've got a suspension bridge to sell them.
Martin Fodor from the Green Party, what do you make of? It would be probably save petrol, maybe, if people were.
I think there's two ways of looking at it. Firstly, e-voting, there's pluses and minuses about it, and one of the big pluses is that younger people are far more likely to participate in democracy through apps or electronic systems, because that's what they're used to doing. They're used to ordering and buying and voting and doing everything online on their smartphone, lots and lots. So certainly it would be positive for parties like the Green Party if, firstly, the voting age was lowered because young people are more sympathetic, and secondly, because the participation would rise if there were easier ways to do it. But I could add a different side, is that paper ballots, using pencils and bits of paper, there are ways they can be spoiled and cheated as well. And I'm actually a UK member of the Congress at the Council of Europe, which is the Council of Europe covers all 47 European countries, and the local and regional government chamber that I'm part of actually goes out and helps observe elections in local and regional authorities across Europe. And there are parts of Europe where people come out of the polling stations and are observed collecting their $50 or $100 or whatever the vote sells for after showing the picture of who they voted for, as they leave the polling station, or they're brought up in a bus, sent into the polling station, and then all collected and taken away again by someone who's presumably looking after them. We don't know what that implies. So there are plenty of ways to cheat traditional
methods. That might be the Green Party taking them all to vote. Mightn't it? Because they maybe can't get to the vote polling station.
Go by public transport if they have to, but I'm not saying they're trying to cheat elections, certainly. But well, I'm just saying that there are pros and cons of both methods of voting, and there are worries about voting here. We had out-of-date ballots in elections here in Bristol the day I was elected. We had a polling station moved a week before to a much more distant and difficult to get to venue up a hill from a large part of my ward.
So smart voting is a bit like smartphones, the smart grid, smart meters.
It's a way of voting.
I'm not sure it's so smart.
Well, people will be able to participate. It's the safeguards that matter, and I think there will be worries about the safeguards, the vulnerability to hacking.
Everyone is having to do everything online nowadays, and one of the things
it could increase participation.
One of the things you're finding is that, for example, banks are closing because they're saying, "Well, we don't need to come into the bank anymore. We just do it all online." And there was a question about that at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Ian Blackford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2008, we collectively bailed out the Royal Bank of Scotland at a cost of £45 billion. In 2017, the Royal Bank of Scotland are paying us back by turning their backs in 259 of our communities. Given we are the majority shareholder, will the Prime Minister step in and tell the Royal Bank of Scotland to stick to their commitment and not close the last bank in town?
I'd say, as I think the Right Honourable Gentleman knows, the decision to open and close branches is a commercial decision taken by the banks without intervention from the government. But we do recognise the impact this has on communities. And the Secretary of State for Scotland raised concerns of that the House have expressed on this issue in his meeting with RBS. Of course, more people are banking online. This is having an impact, but we do want to ensure that all customers, especially vulnerable ones, can still access over-the-counter services. And that's why we've established the Access to Banking Standard, which commits banks to carry out a number of steps before closing a branch. And the Post Office have also reached an agreement with the banks that will allow more customers than ever before to use Post Office services. So we recognise the importance of this on communities and have acted in a number of ways.
Blackford.
If the Prime Minister recognises the importance of this, she should be summoning Ross McEwan in to see her and making it clear. that we will not accept towns and villages up and down the United Kingdom losing banking services. There are 13 towns in Scotland where the last bank will be going. This is not acceptable. It is about time the Prime Minister accepted her responsibilities. Will she summon Ross McEwan and will she tell the Royal Bank of Scotland this must be reversed?
The decisions on opening and closing branches is a commercial matter for the banks.
I don't know actually if any more of that was much of a helpful answer, but Martin Summers on this one, I mean, we're going to end up surely with actually no banks, with all banking being done online.
Well, I think more important in this particular case is RBS is owned by the government, but the government doesn't bother to try and tell it what to do, because the whole idea is that they're going to compete their way back into being a private sector bank.
It's a commercial decision.
But in actual fact, what the 2008 crisis showed and the bailout of the whole financial sector, because of course, if RBS had been allowed to collapse, it would have dragged down the rest of them with it, which is why it had to be rescued. And that was an opportunity squandered, because at that point, we could have actually thought, well, what's the banking system for? It's actually fallen into the hands of the government, and we could use it as a mechanism to empower local communities, to empower small and medium enterprises, to have an industrial strategy, etc. But instead, we've just tried to resurrect them as the same old load of rubbish they were before they were nationalised.
Martin Fodor?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, talking about banks as sort of positive partners in development in our communities is very much Green Party policy. I'd like to see far more community controlled and community-influenced investment. I'm down to one single bank in my ward now, and that is a threat to local traders who still handle a lot of cash and are going to find it more difficult, more expensive to bank at the end of the day.
Isn't it inevitable we're just going to go to a cashless society fairly soon?
Well, a cashless society is very good for banks who control all the transactions. It's probably good for those who want to scan all those transactions to see what we're doing. But I think it's been overrated. Certainly, it's convenient, and I can use cashless transactions for my Bristol Pound account, but at least I know my Bristol Pound transactions are staying in the local economy the second time, the third time, the fourth time that money is spent. So they're actually supporting local businesses. They're not leaving the city at the speed of light and kind of being invested somewhere else.
Well, your leader, Caroline Lucas, mm-hmm. who's the only Green MP, Brighton and Hove, is it?
Yes.
MP. Caroline Lucas was at Prime Minister's Questions as well this week, talking about the Chancellor, who seemed to be implying that the reason for the poor figures for productivity in Britain was because of disabled people.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week I tabled a written question to the Chancellor asking for the evidence behind his extraordinary claim to the Treasury Select Committee that disabled workers are responsible for the UK's productivity problems. Last night I received his written answer. Unsurprisingly, there is no such evidence for that claim. So, disgracefully, since he so far declined to express any regret, will the Prime Minister take back control and order the Chancellor to withdraw his remark and apologise for inaccurate and offensive comments?
Yeah. Say to the Honourable Lady that actually the Chancellor did not express the views that she claimed that he was expressing. This is a government that values the contribution that disabled people make to our society and to our economy in the workplace. This is a government that is actually working to ensure that we can see more disabled people getting into the workplace. We've had some success, there's more to do, but we will continue to work to ensure that those disabled people who want to work are able to do so.
Well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with someone wanting to work, being able to get to a workplace and be accepted in employment or create their own employment. But I think it's an appalling thing when someone blames low productivity in this country on the fact that there are people with different abilities and the fact that actually some jobs are harder to do.
Well, Prime Minister's saying that that's actually not what Philip Hammond said.
It sounded like it was what he said from what I know.
Martin, what about this whole idea? New drive is effectively to get disabled people into work. Actually, we've got mass unemployment at the same time.
Well, yes, and the other thing is that the productivity problem is because of lack of investment. Everybody knows who studies economics that that's what determines productivity. It's not the question of individual skills. It's that we have much lower investment per worker than our competitors in Germany, France, etc. And that's because a lot of money in this country gets wasted on property speculation. The banks are run by a bunch of shysters. And, of course, the government has no conception of how ordinary people at the bottom of the pile actually get by, and which is why they come up with stupid ideas like universal credit, which is a solution, you know, it's a solution worse than the problem it claims to resolve.
What do both of you make of the vote earlier this week on Brexit, saying that there needs to be a ratification of whatever deal Theresa May makes on Brexit by Parliament? Because the problem here is that the EU is not going to accept that. So they make a deal with Theresa May. Theresa May goes away, tries to get Parliament to agree to that deal. It's quite within the rights of the European Union to say, well, we don't actually recognise Parliament, we recognise what Theresa May is saying.
Well, that's very interesting, because, of course, it is one government and 27 other governments trying to negotiate. But, for instance, in Brussels, I would hope MEPs have a view on it, because they're concerned about the future of Europe. And certainly the sovereignty of Parliament, which is what a lot of this was allegedly about.
But surely the referendum... Hang on, the referendum is about the sovereignty of the people, not Parliament. It's the people deciding on that referendum,
so
not Parliament.
So should there be another referendum then? Is that what you're arguing?
No, I'm saying is that the decision's been made by the people, and the people are effectively a sovereign, not Parliament, in that decision. I mean, you know, it depends whether you believe in democracy or not, and what democracy means.
What do you mean by the British Constitution, Tony, because the British Constitution is absolutely clear that Parliament is sovereign. And it has been since 1688. And in fact, if Parliament...
they shouldn't allow referendums then,
There were several referendums in Northern Ireland in which the Nationalists refused to participate. They could have a referendum in the whole nine counties of Ulster. And in any case, the six counties of Northern Ireland voted to remain
inside
the
EU. So what will happen if there's a deal done and then Parliament just throws it out?
Well, if that happens, then the deal will not be done. But in fact, I think European countries are rather happy that Parliament has stuck its finger in, because they fear that the Brexit...
Well, it helps them
the Brexiteers
in the negotiations.
On the right of the Tory party will try and put a push for a deal to be smashed.
It helps the EU in the negotiations, which is why these MPs have been called traitors.
Well, that's been called, the Tory MPs have been called traitors by their own party, have actually acted in line with what the CBI, the TUC and various other institutions in this country want. They're entitled to their views.
Okay.
And the fact is, it's not clear that Brexit can happen.
One final story. Over 60,000 people demand Richard Branson returns £328,000. He won suing the National Health Service. I mean, this is one of the unforeseen circumstances of privatising the health service.
Selling off the National Health Service, which has been continuing apace, with very little comment, unfortunately. This is the kind of consequence that we face.
I think I'll put a link up on our show page to that petition, if you'd like to join everyone who's saying that Branson should pay that money back to the NHS,
absolutely,
who he's just been suing. £328,000, Martin.
Well, as I said, when they brought in this so-called top-down reform of the health service that we weren't going to have under the coalition, what will happen if you don't accept the lowest price, these doctors' collectives that are supposedly doing all this, they will sue, and under competition legislation from the EU and elsewhere, they will get money back from you if they don't get the contract.
Okay, final story, and I really am saying that this time. The senior Prince William and Harry could refuse Charles's request to let Camilla be queen. Princes William and Harry may not allow Charles to make Camilla queen when he becomes king. Apparently she's going to be consort or something.
To be honest, I haven't actually seen that story, but sort of amusing irrelevancy of the royal family, perhaps, to me.
Yeah, I can't really work up much enthusiasm to care about this, I'm afraid.
Does it matter if Camilla can't be queen or not?
Not compared to all sorts of things that are much more important.
Okay, all right. Well, that's time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, who is Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor.
You're welcome.
You can join us after the news as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.